TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Arne Gundersen visits refugees of Fukushima. After the explosions and meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant on March 11, 2011, 160,000 people were evacuated. 5 years later, almost 100,000 of them are still living in refugee housing. Their homes, land, and towns are still too radioactive for life. The current Abe government of Japan has begun a campaign to end the refugee crisis by a variety of measures. By changing the radiation standards and telling the exiled that it is now safe to go home. By ending disaster payments as well as cost of living allowances unless they return to the broken down ghost towns or relocate to other parts of Japan. In several cases, Arne Gundersen was the first outsider who came to visit these refugee colonies that are scattered across Japan. Their personal stories hold a kind of truth and significance that no official statements can convey. What Arne Gundersen had to offer the refugees in return is 45 years of experience. He was a licensed reactor operator who taught reactor physics and served as senior vice president for the nuclear industry. His expertise is in nuclear power engineering design defects, safety flaws, decommissioning, and dismantlement. He became a whistleblower in 1990 and lost his job and even his home. He's now an independent consultant. He is part of his diary on his moving and heartbreaking meetings with refugees. Arne Gundersen by phone from Japan, recorded in March 2016 by the crew at his nonprofit, fairwinds.org.
Today I went to a resettlement community, and there were 22 women who met us out of 66 families that live in this resettlement community. And they stood up and they said, "My name is..." "And I'm in 6A. My name is, and I'm in 11B. And that's how they define themselves, is where they, the little cubicle that they lived in. It was very sad. And they had their unofficial mayor, the woman who sort of runs all the groups. And she was very nice. And she told us that after the disaster at Fukushima, her hair fell out, she got a bloody nose, and her body was speckled with hives and boils. And the doctor told her it was stress, and she believes him. It was absolutely amazing. And we explained that those are all symptoms of radiation, and she should have it looked into. And she really felt like her doctor had her best interest in heart, and she was not going to pursue it. So they told us that we were the first people in 5 years to come to them and talk to them about radiation. Nobody in 5 years of their exile had ever talked to them about radiation before, which was another terribly sad moment. So I asked them, I said, "Who do you trust?" And they said, "Well, we get a letter from TEPCO once a month, Tokyo Electric Power Company, and we read the local newspaper, and that's how we get our information." So we asked them what it was like. Did they feel isolated from the rest of Japan? And they said some of them have changed their license plates so they're not in Fukushima anymore, so that their license plates show they're from another location. But when they drive back into Fukushima and people realize that they're natives, people deliberately scratch their cars. Deliberately scratch their cars because they're sort of traitors. And then we had the opposite hold true. The people didn't change their plates. And when they left Fukushima and went to other areas, people deliberately scratched their cars because they were from Fukushima. As really said, it's a small minority of people, but it keeps you constantly on your toes about who you can trust. This animosity toward you, as if you're the person that caused the nuclear disaster.
Isn't it true, Arnie, that after World War II, the survivors of the bombing at Nagasaki and Hiroshima were taunted a lot, and also many of them had to not tell their stories or say they had been at either Nagasaki or Hiroshima because they were the untouchables?
We have one with us. We have a 76-year-old man who was 6 years old when the bomb was dropped. And he talked eloquently today about the people who tried to hide their identities, the problems that they encountered, because when they hid their identities, they couldn't get the medical services that they needed for the injuries they had experienced from the bomb. But then if they told everyone they were from Nagasaki or Hiroshima, they were ostracized in the communities. There was no safe place to be. Now, he's 76 and spoke to the women about his experience, and they were very grateful to hear that they're not alone with the stigma of being exposed to radiation. He told me that for the first 5 years after the bomb, he was a medical wreck. He was emaciated and lots of medical problems, which over time he overcame. And by the time he was 20, he became an Olympic bicyclist. He was affected by the bomb and through good food and good medicine was able to recover and has lived a full life. So he's a pretty special human being, wonderful man. And he's one of the lucky ones. He's 76 and doesn't have cancer and is active and vital. So it's very much an individual lucky situation. He was not at ground zero, but he was near enough to be contaminated and experience the disaster. So most of the people at ground zero were obliterated in a flash. So he's a special man.
One of the things that you've talked about and Marco has talked about is internal radiation exposures and hot particles. What's the difference between a bomb exploding and a nuclear plant exploding and hot particles?
Most of the bomb exposure was from a direct flash that was over in seconds. There wasn't a significant amount of contamination on the ground because the bomb went off 1,000 feet in the air. So there was not a lot of radiation residual left on the ground for hot particles to get into people's lungs. There were people downwind that breathed in hot particles from the thunderstorms that it created, things like that. But
you mean in fallout?
Yes, in fallout, downwind from the Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And they experienced something called the black rain, and dust particles did come down hundreds of miles away. And so those people are also exposed. But he was at very near ground zero. So his exposure was a flash of external radiation, not a lot of internal radiation to damage organs. And that's not what we're seeing in Fukushima Daiichi. Everything I'm finding here is millions and billions of very, very small particles that are spread pretty much everywhere. We'll know a little bit more about that in the future.
I appreciate you answering the question. I've been wondering about it because they were trying to claim everything is okay in Japan. Look how well most of the Japanese recovered from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so, therefore, it's okay. Don't look this way. There's nothing here to see.
Yeah, there's no comparison between a bomb and what happened to Fukushima. The bomb obliterated maybe a pound of uranium. And it was 1,000 feet in the air, so most of it went up almost immediately. Whereas each of the nuclear reactors at Fukushima had 100 tons of uranium in them, so that the quantity of radiation that's spread out throughout the countryside is orders of magnitude higher at Fukushima than it was at Nagasaki. You know, we had another thing that amazed me was the way the Japanese are paying off the victims is creating a lot of animosity. This community was special. All 22 women knew each other for a long time. Some were in their 60s, and one was as young as 17. And one of the women in her 60s was living with her 88-year-old mother when the disaster occurred. So, and the 88-year-old mother was in fine health and loved her community. And when they moved her, she fell apart and died very quickly. because she wasn't in the environment she was used to. And she's actually listed as one of the fatalities now. There's over 1,000 people who the Japanese say, you know, died as a result of the nuclear disaster. So she's one of those people. The 17-year-old is not allowed to go back in. The Japanese don't let women under 18 back in. So we asked her, when you turn 18, will you go back? And she said, I will go back once to pay my respects, and I will never go back again. But the older women had a different attitude. You know, it was the home of their children. And their ancestors are all there. You know, the family ancestral burial grounds are all there, and they have to take care of their ancestors so that they desperately want to go back. We had one woman who cannot go back. She's been told that her house is an area is so contaminated, she will never go back. And then we had other women who were been told they might have to wait 3 or 4 or 5 more years, but they probably will go back. And then we had a few that thought they might go back in a year or two. Now, what the Japanese government does is when you never can go back, they give you a lump sum of money, which allows you to buy a house. And in some communities, there's a lot of animosity because these people can now have a house and they don't have to live in these resettlement situations. And the other people who may go back in 5 years are not given any money, and they're kept in these resettlement communities and in limbo until their homes are ready. One of the women lost her house in the tsunami, but the ground around it was so contaminated that she could never build there. So what the Japanese government did was they paid her for the foundation.
That's horrible.
So she got nothing for the house that was destroyed. She got a small amount of money for the foundation of the house, which can never be built on because it's too radioactive. And she's essentially stuck in this resettlement home for life. Yeah, you're right. It's horrible. Now, in some communities, these tensions manifest themselves in all sorts of internal hatred. But this community seemed to overcome it. There was a wonderful woman from Rwanda who escaped the Rwandan genocide because she spoke Japanese, and they got resettled in Fukushima and then had to flee Fukushima. But she seemed to be the spark plug to keep people happy and glad that they had each other.
I think back to Dante, and I think back to purgatory. You know, limbo, being in limbo is purgatory, and just a hellacious place to be. And it's, to my way of thinking, it's so incongruous with how I see Japan. And I look at these pictures that you sent of where you went yesterday in the resettlement village, and there's no feeling of permanency. There's no feeling to put the artistic and spiritual beauty back in the environment that I have always internalized as being Japanese.
When we left, they sang a song to us. One of them is an accomplished musician, and she wrote a beautiful song about their hometown. And they sang it, and it was haunting. It was so beautiful. And they talked about how nice the town was and all the special things in the town and how sad they felt to leave it. And that was the only time I saw them cry. Every one of them broke into tears at the end of the song. You know, the scars are deep. They seem to be focused their lives together, and that's more important than where they live and how they live, is that they're all together. It was very special, but terribly sad. And after that, we went to see a family that was in the lumber business, and their hillside that they take the lumber from is so contaminated they can't use it anymore. So they have to actually import lumber from around the country. So we asked the family, what's changed for you since the disaster? And their answer was swift. Everything has changed. Nothing is as it was. And then they went and they used to go up into the woods to, to not just to harvest their livelihood, the wood, but they used the fruits and vegetables and mushrooms and things like that that were up in the forest to live on. And they can't get any of that. They can't eat the shiitake mushrooms. They can't eat the fruits that are up there. They can't use the ferns, the salad. There's absolutely nothing in their life that hasn't been torn out from under them. The personal toll, you can't quantify it. There's no way to put a dollar figure on any of this. There's 160,000 people that are each individually experiencing this. And you had it right. I think I used the word, it was limbo. I said, these people are in that place that's not heaven, not hell, and they just are in some sort of a holding pattern in their lives. And it was terribly sad to see the destructive force that the atom can be. All these women were in their 60s, and they said that they would go back because they know they'll probably die of something before they die of cancer. But their kids have already moved on. And their kids won't be back in the village that they grew up in. And their kids won't be back to take care of the ancestors. And then their grandkids are not allowed back now. And by the time they get to 18 years old, they will have forgotten the village. So the keepers of the village tradition are all 50, 60, 70 years old. And when they die, their kids are not going to keep that village alive. So it's very much a death sentence for the villages, a slow death. If they get back into them, there will be no generations to come.
What touched me is, by village, you mean their community, their sense, their entire community that had generations of tradition. And that is totally fragmented. And that's true for thousands of people.
Yeah, there's 160,000 people living in temporary housing, and 60,000 now have been displaced back into high radiation areas, but another 100,000 are still waiting to get pushed off and into high radiation areas that I don't believe they should be going back to. That's a lot of people. Now, that's the size of it's the size of a big piece of the state of Fukushima. And their lives are permanently torn asunder.
The other thing that you said that really concerned me and upset me, women are so much more radiologically sensitive than men. These children are not allowed to go back until they're 18. But when they're 18, they can go back. And for women and 18-year-olds, that's when your reproductive organs are still really, really vulnerable. And you would go back, and if you were exposed and you were going to start a family, that's a really tragic amount of exposure for someone that age, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, you little girls are 20 times more radiosensitive than older adults like me. Little boys are 10 times more radiosensitive. By the time they hit 20 years old, they're still girls 3 or 4 times more radiosensitive and young men about twice as radio sensitive as older adults. So, yeah, when you send a young family back, if they go back, and most are refusing to go back, they're moving on and lying about their location where they came from. But if they go back, they know that the likelihood of a cancer is dramatically higher than it would have been.
That was Arne Gundersen of fairwinds.org, talking with his wife, Maggie. He called in from his 2016 tour of Japan on the 5th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. A week later, he had arrived at the Sendai nuclear power plant in Kobe. This phone call was recorded on March 3rd, 2016.
I'm in Kobe. That's the site of that huge earthquake back in 1995. But then we're heading down to the Sendai reactor, and that's the one that's right near the volcano. So I might get to see a volcano later. It was dormant for quite a long while, and then when the Japanese decided to start up Sendai, the gods decided to start up the volcano.
So who will be your audience today?
The audience is a mixture. We've spoken to a lot of YMCA organizations, believe it or not, but we also spoke to UNICEF. And just yesterday, I spoke to the Kobe Co-op. If you're in the States, you think of these co-ops as the little local store you've got in town. But the Kobe Co-op has got an 8-story building. They're just absolutely huge. So, you know, I think the interesting thing is, regardless of who I'm speaking to, they're all interested. We bumped into a lot of women. And I'm sure there's hundreds, if not thousands of them in southern Japan who have taken their kids and left. Yesterday, I met one and she said her parents are calling her, and the exact word was a traitor to Japan. because she's left. Another woman told us that her family told her that if everybody ate the same food and everybody went and hung out together in Fukushima Prefecture, it would be fine because everybody was there. A famous doctor here in Japan is saying that the best cure for radiation is smiling. You know, the pressure these families are on to reunite in Fukushima Prefecture is enormous, but I have to give the women a lot of credit. They are against all odds, they've taken their kids and they're in a much safer location.
Arnie, do you know what they're now doing for a living, job-wise, or how these women are being able to support their children and support themselves while they're going against family and potentially their spouses?
They find jobs in the local communities. When their families are intact, their husbands continue to send them money. One of the women I met, more than one, there's several whose husbands are divorcing them. And in the Japanese court system, if the judge believes that there's no such thing as radiation and that her fears are unfounded, the kid goes back with the father. And there's a lot of that here. But the other interesting thing is that there are many communities who want these women. Japan's rural areas are depopulating. Some of these villages have half the houses are empty. As people die and the young people go to the cities, large portions of these little tiny towns are unpopulated. So a lot of cities are competing to get these families back into a home, and there's actually agencies that do it. But the problem is a lot of the women go, but the husbands stay behind. So we're having these broken families.
Let me see if I get this right. These cities that are not near Fukushima Daiichi and not near the radiation are recruiting people who have been living in refugee camps or who are refugees from the radiation to come and live in homes that they have there that they could provide for them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they're nice homes, and these are nice villages. The problem from the women's standpoint is that the village doesn't come with them. All of the village ties, they can't take the entire village. But there's enough houses in some of these towns to take, a half a dozen or a dozen families in a dozen homes. So it is possible you could be with your group of friends, but not your entire village. The biggest issue, it seems to me, in this far south in Japan, far away from Fukushima, is they'd like to keep these rural towns alive. So they're actually encouraging of it. But the government doesn't want it. Somebody told me yesterday that the government's motive here is they don't want any refugees by the time the Olympics happen in 2020. Their position is you either move back or you have moved to another community. But all of the funds for refugees will be eliminated so they can tell the world that Fukushima has been solved. The people in the prefecture who stay are just absolutely unwilling to admit there's any radiation anywhere. But I think the moms really understand that, especially while their children are young, the best thing to do is to get the heck out regardless of the social pressure. It's sad. It's ripping the society apart at a time when they really should be drawing together. And it looks to me like the issue of moving people out of Fukushima could help these towns that are dying because the old people are moving on.
Arnie, what else would you like to share with us from your meetings and interviews?
Well, I personally met a doctor the day before yesterday. His clinic was put out of business by the Japanese government. What they did was they never really said, we're putting you out of business. They just stopped paying his bills. He was treating people, and on the symptoms, he would say, radiation related. So any bill he submitted that was radiation related, they refused to pay. We've had the doctors say they were threatened with hospital privileges and things like that. But this is just another one of those schemes. The guy had to close his clinic because he wasn't being reimbursed for the services. The Japanese government's position is when your hair falls out and your nose starts to bleed and you're hacking up blood, that's all stress related. And unless you put on the form that it's stress-related as opposed to radiation-related, they just refuse to pay.
Well, you did say there was that one person who said, if you put a smile on your face, then it'll all go away.
That's a commonly held attitude. I mean, that was the highest ranking person in government to say it. But this issue, if we all hang together, then the radiation will be fine. There's, you know, obviously there's no scientific basis on it, but it's just the culture of if we all do the same thing, then we'll all be protected. You know, it reminds me of that nursery story about the emperor has no clothes. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the crowd was convinced that the emperor had a beautiful gown on. And as long as they all told the same story, everything was fine until the little kid chirped out, you know, this guy's naked. And that's really the role the mothers have here. The mothers are saying that this is a scam. I'm not going to risk my kid's health because you guys you want to sing a happy song. So they've moved on.
That was Arne Gundersen. You heard phone calls he made to the crew at his nonprofit, fairwinds.org. He spoke live from Japan during his February-March 2016 visit on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. And if you would like to hear more, go to the website fairwinds.org. That's F-A-I-R-E winds.org. This is the conclusion of a four-part series made in appreciation of Gundersen's work. Gundersen had been invited to speak to community groups in Japan on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima meltdown. And as I'm sending you by radio his telephone reports in mid-March 2016, he is still there, learning and teaching. Gundersen has made many visits to Japan since 2011 and is well known and respected there. His book, Fukushima Daiichi, Truth and the Way Forward, was translated into Japanese and is a bestseller. Arne Gundersen has consulted on nuclear energy safety for the state of Vermont, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, Sierra Club, and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. He testified on the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown and the San Onofre and Vermont Yankee nuclear plants. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin called Gundersen the only person in the state of Vermont who's been right on every single prediction of what might happen at Vermont Yankee. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.